Your resume and cover letter are the first impression and introduction you give to a potential new employer. Where your resume ends up depends largely on the company you're applying to and the systems they have in place. Larger companies typically have a recruiting department responsible for reviewing the applicants first before the resumes go to the hiring manager, especially when there's a lot of applicants for one job. Smaller companies may direct any applicants directly to the hiring manager. This is something to be aware of. As a dietitian, I can review a resume and make sense of the information on the resume. But if the applications and resumes are being reviewed by a recruiting department first, things can get a little more complicated. This is why your resume should be clearly organized and use the language the company uses. Otherwise, it could get lost in a large pile and thrown aside. Also, with advances in technology, many companies use software to scan resumes and applications looking for keywords to quickly sort through who does and does not meet the job requirements. The keywords are largely based on the job description. That's one purpose of the job description. I know a dietitian who had 10 years experience as a clinical dietitian who applied to a clinical dietitian job at a large organization. Her resume was thrown aside and she was told she didn't meet the minimum qualifications for the job. She absolutely met the minimum qualifications, but what happened was the recruiter didn't understand the abbreviations we use in dietetics. On her resume, she put that she was a CSR. The recruiter, not being a dietitian, didn't know what that meant, and sad to say, they didn't take the time to look it up. The job description required the applicants to have a certification or a master's degree. Well, the CSR is a certification. And on the list of approved certifications for the job, it listed certified specialist in renal. We as dietitians know that the CSR is a certified specialist in renal, but the recruiter was simply following the job description and didn't pay enough attention and wasn't inquisitive enough to look into it further. I share this story because the layout of your resume matters. How you organize your resume makes a big difference between getting an interview where you can sell yourself and show a company who you are or having your application thrown out due to a misunderstanding. So as you begin your job search and start applying to jobs, consider having someone who isn't a dietitian review your resume and see if it clearly illustrates and represents you and all the amazing qualities you'll bring to a company. And take the time to research the company you're applying to and the job description or job posting for the position you're applying to. Incorporate some of the language they use for that job. I recommend creating a different resume for each job you apply to. I have many different versions of my resume and tailor it to the job I'm applying to, highlighting different experiences I've had and different projects I've worked on. If you take that extra step, you decrease the risk of your application being pushed aside when it deserves to land right in front of the hiring manager. You have so much to offer and contribute. Don't let a technicality or misunderstanding stop you from being seen for the incredible professional you are. I'm Jana Nickel, and this is the RD Exam Made Easy podcast. This episode covers management duties and responsibilities. Dietitians need to understand the role of management. If you're a visual learner and need to write things out in order for numbers in particular to click, grab yourself a pencil and paper and get ready. You're going to want to make sure you can work through some of the math because it's fair game on the RD exam. There's a lot to cover, so let's get to it. I wanted to start with work schedules. One of the responsibilities of management is to put together work schedules. A work schedule lets employees know when they're scheduled to come to work. Super important if you want people to show up to work. The work schedule includes the day the employee works, the start time, and the end time. It may also include the tasks an employee will be doing during their shift. For example, if you're putting together a work schedule for the clinical dietitian team, you need to make sure all the units in the hospital are covered and assigned to the dietitians working that day. If you're the director of a food service department in a hospital, there's lots of different tasks such as dishwashing, food prep, meal assembly, and tray delivery, to name a few. All of these tasks are essential and need to be covered. A manager makes sure that these tasks are covered. A master schedule identifies the number of staff needed in order for all the tasks to get done. When managing callouts or leave of absences, referencing back to the master schedule can help with coverage. So that's a work schedule for the department. Let's go over the type of schedules employees might have. A full-time work schedule is when an employee works full-time. The minimum amount of required work hours varies between companies, but generally speaking, it's safe to say that 40 hours per week is considered full-time. With a full-time work schedule, most employees will work the same shift and the same schedule every week. This is also called a fixed work schedule. If the schedule varies, such as evening and day shifts, the full-time employee must still be given 40 hours per week. Many companies are Monday to Friday, so full-time work schedules have employees working every day, Monday to Friday. For companies that are 24/7 businesses, such as hospitals, employees may rotate weekends. If that's the case, they'll need to have a day off for each weekend shift they work. Again, a full-time employee must work and get paid 40 hours for that week. Part-time work schedules are when employees work less than 40 hours per week. The minimum work hours required varies depending on the company. Part-time employees typically don't get the same benefits as full-time employees. Their benefits may be prorated based on how many hours they work. If more hours are available, part-time employees can pick up extra hours and can become full-time if the hours are available and if the employee chooses to do so. Some companies may have different shifts, such as day shift, evening shift, and then night shift, which is also called graveyard shift. Nurses come to mind when thinking about graveyard shifts. Many companies will pay their employees a higher wage when they start their shift after a certain time. This is called pay differential or shift differential. And then lastly, per diem employees or on-call employees work whenever there is a need. Those employees are not guaranteed any hours and they typically aren't given any benefits. The company may have minimum expectations of the on-call or per diem employee. But generally speaking, those employees are considered on-call, meaning that they're only provided hours based on an on-call need. Those employees will typically have another job that does provide a more stable and secure income. Having said that, some people really like the flexibility of being per diem and on-call, especially if they're not dependent on any of the benefits. So moving on to unions. A union is an organization that's formed by workers to give the workers a voice. The union bargains with the organization for wages, benefits, and workplace issues such as workplace safety and workflows. It's called collective bargaining, and once an agreement is established between the company and the union, they have to follow what is called a collective bargaining agreement. The agreement is followed by both workers and management. Within a union, there's representatives for the union workers. These representatives are called union stewards or shop stewards. A union steward participates in any labor disputes and is responsible for sharing union information with the other union workers or employees. Union workers choose the representatives to negotiate for them. It's a democratic process. If a union worker has an issue or problem in the workplace, they have the right to address their concerns with the union steward. The employer is not allowed to prevent a union employee from going to the union. So what about filling job postings in a union? Employees who are represented by a union advance based on seniority. Unions are seniority driven. Basically, seniority rules. Seniority is primarily used when employees apply for or bid on a job. It's also important for vacation bidding, which is usually done annually. That's when everyone in the department puts in their vacation requests for that year. The manager and union may work together to make sure vacation time is granted by seniority. With regards to filling open positions, the employee who applies with the most seniority will be given the position. It's not based on who is most qualified for the job. Typically, the minimum qualifications for a position need to be met. For example, if a certification is required for a particular job and it's listed in the job description, whoever applied needs to meet the minimum qualifications. As long as the employee meets those requirements, the position will go to the most senior bidder. Say you have two employees who are applying for a cook position. One has met the minimum qualifications, say 2 months of cooking experience is what the job description says. And another employee has years of work experience as a cook. Maybe they have 10 years experience. If the job description says that the employee only needs 2 months of work experience, then if that person is most senior with the 2 months of cooking experience, we'll get the job over the employee with 10 years of cooking experience. It goes by seniority. The employee that's worked for the company the longest will be given priority for that position. Or let's say you have two dietitians bidding on a nutrition support position. The minimum requirements based on the job description say that the dietitian needs to have 6 months of critical care experience. One of your dietitians was a critical care dietitian for many years at a previous company. Another dietitian on your team who's interested in the job has only been covering the critical care department for about 6 months. If the job description says 6 months is required, and that person has worked for the company the longest, the position will go to the dietitian with 6 months experience who's worked for the company the longest. That's how seniority works in a union. Now, since we've talked a little bit about job descriptions already, let's go over what they are. The job description outlines the tasks that are typically required within that job. It also outlines any educational requirements, degrees, or anything the employee must have in order to do the job successfully. For example, a dietitian job description would say that a registered dietitian credential is required through the Commission on Dietetic Registration, or CDR, if you're a dietitian in the United States. In order to be a dietitian at that company, you must have a registered dietitian credential. Job descriptions can also be helpful if an employee isn't performing to a manager's expectations. If the task is in the job description and the employee has been trained to perform the task, but they're not meeting the performance expectations, then the job description is helpful and can be used when addressing the performance issues with that employee. Let's say the employee has some performance issues, or maybe they made a mistake. The issue should be investigated. The manager should gather all the facts around what happened in order to see the big picture. Say, for example, one of the dietitians on your team documented something incorrectly in the medical record. The first step you do as a manager is not fire the employee. If that's a question on the exam and one of the options is to fire the employee as the first step, don't choose that answer. The correct steps to take are to assess the situation and try to figure out what happened and why. Maybe you find out after fact-finding that there's an issue with workflow that needs to be addressed. After the data is collected and you know what happened, you want to come up with a solution. The goal is to prevent the mistake from happening again. If you're following a democratic leadership style, the employees would give input on the solution. Once the solution to the problem is identified and implemented, the manager is responsible for following up and making sure there's no drift. Drift is when employees go back to the old ways of doing things. Managers regularly have to deal with these type of scenarios, so it's possible you'll get some kind of a scenario question on the exam. Remember to use your common sense. Think about the most logical approach. The answer on the exam is never to make a knee-jerk reaction and fire someone from their job, at least not immediately. You always want to make sure that you investigate and determine what happened and why. So regardless of the outcome, even if the person ends up being terminated, there's still a process that should be followed. If you're not sure what to answer and it feels like none of the answers make sense, try to put yourself in the employee's shoes. You often find clarity when it's more personal. Think about how you would want to be treated if you were the employee who made the mistake. Anytime you're given scenario questions on any exam, the goal is to always be diplomatic and figure out what's going on. The harshest answer, in most cases, is usually not correct. So let's move on to performance appraisals. Managers are responsible for giving their employees performance appraisals, which are usually done every year. I've seen and worked for companies that follow different performance review schedules. Some places require managers to complete all the performance appraisals at the same time every year. Say, for example, March 31st is the deadline for each employee to have their performance evaluation or performance appraisal completed. It can be a busy month for the managers to get all the evaluations done. But once they're done, they don't have to do performance appraisals for another year. Other companies, on the other hand, may follow the employee's work anniversary. Say, for example, I started a job on September 15th. If the company was following the performance appraisal calendar where my evaluations are done on my work anniversary, then my manager would need to complete my performance appraisal on or around September 15th every year. In my experience, I prefer doing all the performance appraisals at the same time every year. While it makes for a busy month, it's much easier than having to remember every employee's work anniversary, especially if you have a lot of employees. I also kind of get in the performance appraisal groove. The performance appraisal is when the employee's performance is addressed. If there's anything that you'd like to see improved as a manager, this is the time to do so. The employee gets a copy of their evaluation, so anything addressed will be in writing so everyone's on the same page. If there's anything you observe throughout the year, though, I don't suggest you wait for the performance appraisal, especially if you notice someone is doing something unsafe that could harm themselves or someone else. That should be corrected in live time. The performance appraisal provides a summary and evaluation of an employee's overall performance that year. One last thing before we move on. I mentioned they're done annually, but for new employees, they may need performance appraisals sooner. It depends on the company policy, but typically a 30-day evaluation or a 90-day evaluation, or maybe even both, may be required. During these evaluations, it gives the employee timely feedback on their performance and gives the employee the opportunity to improve if there are performance concerns right away. This is usually called a probationary period. It gives the employee the chance to see if the job or company is a good fit for them, but it also gives the manager the opportunity to coach the employee. If there are performance concerns with no improvement, even with coaching, the manager can make the decision to terminate the employee. Hopefully, this doesn't happen too often because it's not good for the workplace and it's expensive to recruit and onboard new employees. And ultimately, as managers, we want people to be successful. The last topic you'll learn in this episode is FTEs, or full-time equivalents. If you're a visual learner, you'll want to write this down so you can review your notes. So what in the world is an FTE, or full-time equivalent? It's used to determine how many employees are needed to get the job done. It's also used in the budget of a department. A department's minimum FTEs needed in order to adequately staff the department to meet the department needs is called absolute FTEs. This is the absolute minimum number of FTEs needed on any given day in order to complete the tasks required in the department. So, absolute FTEs are the minimum FTEs needed to staff that department. Now, adjusted FTEs, on the other hand, accounts for the days off for benefits the company gives employees, such as vacation days, sick days, and paid time off. Say, for example, I work 40 hours per week and I get 10 vacation days a year. On the days I use a vacation day, someone needs to be scheduled to cover my shift. On that day, I'll get paid for an 8-hour shift out of my vacation time, and the employee covering my 8-hour shift for me will also get paid to work. That's what's meant by adjusted FTEs. Okay, so let's break down FTEs. One FTE is the same thing as 40 hours per week. So if you're a full-time employee who regularly works 40 hours per week, you're considered one FTE. Now, what if you worked 20 hours per week? Well, if 40 hours per week is one FTE, then 20 hours per week is 0.5 FTEs, or half of a full-time equivalent. Now, let me explain FTEs using something I think is of importance to you. Money. Yes, we all want and deserve to get paid for the work we do. And this math will not only help you with understanding the pay in a job offer that you might get, but it'll also help you if you get asked about FTEs on the exam. Let me give you a little calculation that will be helpful for you when negotiating a salary at a new job. Some jobs may give you an annual salary when they offer you a job. That is typically for management positions or salary positions where the employees don't clock in and out. If you don't clock in and out, you get a set pay regardless of the hours worked. It's based on working 40 hours a week, and that's the typical expectation if you're considered one full-time equivalent or FTE. But this also means that if you work 50 hours a week as a salaried employee, you still only get paid for 40 hours. Because you don't clock in and out in salaried positions, there's no overtime. Hourly employees, on the other hand, clock in and out. They work their shift, and anytime they work over their scheduled shift, they get paid overtime. So let's get back to how you can use this when you get a new job offer, and you need to understand the compensation you'll be given. Say, for example, you're told you'll be making $100 per hour. That sounds fabulous. You're also going to be working 40 hours per week. So how many FTEs is that? Yes, one FTE or one full-time equivalent. Okay, someone who works 40 hours per week or one FTE will work 2,080 hours per year. You can simply memorize this. Again, if you work 40 hours per week, you'll work 2,080 hours per year. If you want to do the math, let's do it. 40 hours per week times 52 weeks a year equals 2,080 hours. Now that you know how many hours you'll be working a year as a full-time employee, you can determine how much you'll make annually without accounting for overtime. So, in order to do that, you'll take 2,080 hours per year times $100 per hour, because remember, that's what this position pays. That will give you $208,000 per year. You can also do this in reverse if you're offered an annual salary and want to know how much that is an hour. Instead of multiplying by 2,080 hours, you'll divide. So if you're told you'll be making $208,000 per year, divide that by 2,080 hours per year, which you'll work, which will give you $100 per hour. Okay, what happens if you're offered a job and you're going to be working less than 40 hours per week? Say, for example, you'll be working 24 hours per week. And say the schedule you're being offered is 3 8-hour shifts per week. To determine how many hours you'll be working a year, you'll take 3 days per week, multiply that by 8 hours per day, which equals 24 hours per week. Then you're going to multiply that by 52 weeks per year, which comes to 1,248 hours per year. Now, if this job also pays $100 per hour, you'll make $124,800 per year. Now, you might be asked to determine how much of the budget is spent on salary based on FTEs. To determine what your daily FTEs are in your department, you'll need to know the total hours worked, including any short shifts, such as 4-hour shifts. You want all the hours worked. Once you have all the hours added up, you divide the total hours by 8 hours. So why do you divide it by 8 hours? Well, it comes back to the baseline equation that one FTE is 40 hours per week, which is typically 5 8-hour shifts. So let's go over an example. If you determine your staff worked a total of 120 hours today, you'll divide 120 by 8, which will give you 15 FTEs that day. So let's move on to weekly FTEs. If you need to determine how many FTEs you worked on a weekly basis, you take the total hours worked that week and divide it by 40, because remember, one FTE is 40 hours per week. So let's go over an example of how to determine annual FTEs. Just like you did for the daily FTEs, you'll add up all the hours worked that year and divide it by 2,080 hours, because remember, one full-time equivalent equals 40 hours per week or 2,080 hours per year. See, I told you that little tricky calculation would come in handy. When it's personal, it's a lot easier to remember. Now, let me give you an example, because for me, I like to have examples. Say you're asked to determine the weekly cost of your dietitian team, which is much smaller than the kitchen operation. Your dietitian FTE is 7.4. That's your budgeted staffing for dietitians, 7.4 FTEs. Your dietitians all make the same hourly rate of $30 per hour. You have a meeting with financing, and you know they're going to ask you how much your dietitians cost the previous week when the hospital went live with a new program. How are you going to calculate your dietitian cost last week? So you're going to take 7.4 FTEs and multiply by 40 hours, because one FTE is 40 hours per week. That comes to 296 hours of dietitian work time. Then multiply the 296 hours of dietitian work time by $30 per hour, which gives you $8,880. So for you to staff 7.4 dietitian FTEs a week at $30 an hour, it will cost the company $8,880. This would be the same if you run your own business and that's your staffing pattern for dietitians. I know that was a lot, and some of you might be cringing at the thought of math right now. Remember, you got this. Listen to this episode again, and if you need to pause it and take notes, do that. Write the equations down and do your math. I promise, the more you do it, the easier it gets. Don't try to get too fancy, unless fancy is your thing. For the exam, I want you to understand the basic concepts and be able to break things down until you get the right answer. You learned a lot in this episode. You learned about management roles, such as putting together work schedules and giving performance appraisals. You learned about job descriptions and what they're for, how they help you as an employee, and how they also help you as a manager. You also learned about unions and how union stewards, or also called shop stewards, represent the union workers in a department and organization. And lastly, you learned about FTEs. You learned how to do the math and figure out how much you'll be paid when you're given a job offer. And you now know how to calculate the daily, weekly, and annual FTEs if you're asked to do so on the exam. And to make things a little easier, I made a quick cheat sheet for you to show you the calculations. You can find the link to your cheat sheet in the show notes. It's a lot to know, but I know you can do this. Don't let all of this scare you away from becoming a manager if that's something you're interested in doing. I always find when you study things without context, it's a lot more confusing than when you actually apply the information on a daily basis. All of this might seem so overwhelming. And when you first do anything, it's overwhelming and it's new. That's just how it works. But the more you do things, the easier it gets. Plus, anything you do on a daily basis just gets easier with time, especially when it's your job. So don't shut an open door, at least without investigating it first. You never know what's on the other side, and you actually might end up liking what you do. Remember to stay on top of your study game. There's no limits or boundaries to achieving the success you so deeply desire. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and leave a review. Share this episode on Instagram at JanaNicoleRD and help spread the word to other RDs-to-be. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time on the RD Exam Made Easy podcast. Bye for now.